Today I'm going to hopefully finish the discussion of the quantization of non-abelian gauge theories using this procedure of gauge fixing and trying to discuss the renormalization, well, briefly, because it's a bit technical. So remember, what we started to do last time is to define some big functional integral, let us call it Z, that is an integral over all the gauge field configuration for a SU2 gauge field with the usual action for A, where the action is taken to be the integral, well, there is a factor minus 1 over 2 g squared, integral of a space-time, let's call it M, of the trace of the field strength tensor, okay? And both this action and, in fact, the measure, I don't precise what is the measure, but basically that the integral over all points of space-time and all components, gauge group components, and of course, the products of all the Lorentz indices of d a mu a of x, roughly speaking. Both the measure and the action are gauge invariant. Okay. Yes?
Can you explain why the measure is gauge invariant?
Well, believe me. As it is written here, it's not very well defined because it's an infinite product. Well, you can formally look at what is the Jacobian of a gauge transformation over this term and convince yourself that it's gauge invariant. You can just take it as saying that you are trying to define such a functional integral, taking a measure that is scaling, that is gauge invariant, without needing to specify what it is. Okay, the third answer is that there is a rigorous regularization of gauge theories on a lattice that was devised by Ken Wilson, which is so where you have a finite number of degrees of freedom. So it's like discretizing space-time for the scalar field theories that we studied. And so it's a fully rigorous regularization. And it is gauge invariant and local. Okay. Okay, and so we have seen that we integrate over a big space of A of gauge configuration. But of course, the gauge transformation, so we have the big gauge group. The group of all local gauge transformation. We have a space A, the space of MUA of X, the space of gauge potential configuration, gauge potentials space. But we know that under the action of the gauge group, you have orbits where the action doesn't change. So in order to perform a sensible quantization, and in particular, in order to try to define perturbation theory rules, we have to choose what is called, let us call it S, which is a gauge slice, where we enforce some gauge fixing condition that I've wrote in a very sketchy way, f of a equals 0. And I'm going to go back later to discuss that. And so we have to know how to treat this gauge fixing condition in the functional integral in a proper way. Okay. And we have seen that, in particular, for any A, any gauge field configuration, there is a gauge transformation, let us call it G naught, that transform A into another gauge field configuration that satisfies the gauge condition. Okay? So let us, for any A in A, we assume that there is a unique, well, that's a big assumption. It depends on the choice of gauge fixing. But in perturbation theory, that's not important. There is a unique G naught gauge transformation belonging to the gauge group, such that the image of A by the gauge transformation AG naught, which is, remember, G naught A, G naught minus 1 minus d mu, well, minus I, I'm seeing G naught d mu of G naught minus 1, satisfies the gauge condition is such that A of, I'm sorry, F of A of G naught is equal to 0. Okay? But of course, this gauge transformation depends both on A and it depends on the gauge fixing condition. So if you choose another gauge fixing condition, you will have another G naught. Okay. And so I think I finished by noting, so denote it, GF of A. Because it's a gauge transformation, an element of this big gauge group that depends on A, and that depends in addition in the specific gauge fixing conditions that we have chosen. Okay? So now, before discussing what we are going to do in detail, let me start by explaining a little bit more in detail something that I started to explain yesterday, which is basically how to write 1 equals something in a complicated way, seemingly complicated way, but it is the trick that allows to treat this functional integral. This is the trick due to Fadeyev, Popov, and also in gauge theory to Feynman and Price-DeWitt. Okay. So let us consider first one variable, real. Okay, and let us consider, I can write very simply that integral over r of dx of delta of x minus x naught equal 1. That's an obvious property of the Dirac distribution. Okay. Now assume that, in fact, x naught is fixed by the fact that there is some function f such that x naught is defined by the fact that it is a zero of this function. And let us assume in addition that f, so f prime exists, the derivative, and f is monotonic, let us say. So that we are sure that there are only one solution. That the solution is unique. Okay? Then it's easy to see that you can rewrite, you can make the change of variables going from x to f of x. And you can rewrite, so you make the change of variables from x to f of x And then you can rewrite this integral simply as 1 equal integral over dx, delta of f of x, times the absolute value of f prime of x, the absolute value of the derivative of the function here. And in order to do this, obtain this result, you simply make a local change of variables, you linearize your equation in the vicinity of x naught, and you use just a property of the delta function. So this is most trivial. Okay, so is this clear? Yes. Okay, so now let's do that for something a little bit more complicated. For x in some n-dimensional vector space. Okay, so let us assume that now we have some vector space here, and we have some x naught. So now x naught, of course, is a vector. So x will be x1 up to xn. So it's a vector. And let us assume that the point x naught is the root of a vector field. So we have a vector field f of x on Rn, which is just the data of n functions, f1 of the x up to fn of the x. You see, so you have n functions, and x0 is determined by the fact that f of x0 is equal to 0. So this means that you have n equation to be satisfied for n unknown, and let us assume that x0 is unique. Okay? So F is a vector field, F. So it means that basically it's an application from Rn to Rn. Okay? And let us assume that in addition, at least in the vicinity of X naught, the function F has a derivative, well-defined derivative. And in that case, it means that you have to consider the Jacobian matrix. The Jacobian matrix of F, which is simply the matrix that I will denote F prime of X. So it's a matrix, in fact, it's a big matrix, which is the matrix of the covariant derivative of the component with respect to Xg, okay, at point X. Is Ig going from 1 to n. So this Jacobian matrix is n by n matrix. Okay? Then, and we assume, in fact, to mean that the Jacobian matrix is well-defined means that this matrix has no zero eigenvalues. It's non-degenerate. Okay? So in this case, if this works, this equation becomes 1 equal integral over Rn of dx delta of x minus x naught. But we can make the change variable again from x to f. And this becomes integral over Rn dn of x delta of f of x. So this is the delta function still in Rn. But then this becomes the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix F prime of X. And we have to take the absolute value because the Jacobian may be positive or negative. Okay? Good. So now for working in gauge theory, we need to do the same thing, but for integrating in a group, same relation in a Lie group G. Well, let us assume that it is finite dimensional. finite. And let us assume that it is a group like SUn or SON, in particular SU2, so that it's simple and it has a unique R measure. So then this Lie group has a unique, assume, not all Lie groups have a unique, it can be a left or right, but let us assume that it has a unique R measure, which is called d mu of g, that is invariant. And therefore, then we can define, we can take an element g not belonging to the group g, and we can write the equation as 1 equal integral d mu of g, delta of g minus g naught, well, g naught because there is no notion of adding. You can only multiply two elements of the group, where this is just the Dirac delta function centered at g naught. Okay, so it's just a generalization of the delta function to this R measure. You see what I mean? Okay. So now assume that, so the delta function, for instance, has a, is invariant. So for instance, you can check that delta of g1, g2 is equal to delta of g1 times h times g2 times h, if h is an element of the group. Yes?
What's the R measure and how are you defining the roots for this delta function in terms of root elements? I'm not sure how that works.
Pardon?
So, first question, what is the R measure?
Well, the R measure is a unique measure on a group. And for, I think, how are they called? They are called irreducible group or something like that. It's a unique measure on the group. So imagine that you have a group. The group, a Lie group is a group manifold. So you can look at whether you can define a local measure which can be transported by applying on the group. So you are looking for the unique invariant. It can be left or right invariant measure. So that when you integrate a function on the group, d mu of g times f of g is equal to d mu of g, f of g times h. For any function, well, let us write it this, for any function psi from the group to R. Let us say, so you integrate some function over the group, and you want that if you rotate the function, the integral doesn't change. And there is a theorem that states that this R measure is, in general, unique. Well, it is unique, and in general, you can take, multiply to the left or to the right, and for the group that we are considering, the measure is the same. Sometimes it's not the same measure, but that's for some a bit pathological group. Okay?
And how are you defining the zero? In what sense do we have zeros here for that delta function?
At that moment, I have no zeros. I have just defined a delta function.
Okay.
Okay, and the delta function, if you want a correct definition, it is a distribution on the group centered at some point. G naught, for instance, you see? That when you integrate, you pick up the value of the function at the point g naught. So if you want, the delta function is defined by that when you integrate over the group with some function with the Dirac distribution or delta function, what you pick up is just by definition psi at g naught. So this defines a unique distribution. You integrate over the group psi multiplied by this function, so in fact it's a distribution on the manifold on the group, and you pick up psi of g naught. Okay, but it's just ordinary delta function. Okay, so now let me. So in order to generalize that, I want to assume that x naught. Assume that g naught is a solution of an equation f of g naught equals 0. Okay? But now, of course, f will be an application from the Lie group onto the tangent space at some point, so it's into some vector space. And in fact, the tangent space of a Lie group at some point is by definition the Lie algebra of the group. Okay, so this Lie algebra is in fact for what we need. It's just the same thing that some Rn. So it's like a vector space. So we have an application from the group to the Lie algebra, you see, so that to any G, we associate something that I call f of G. Since it's an element of the Lie algebra, you can rewrite it in terms of component as sum over A of some component fa of x times the generators of G. And these are just functions from the group. I'm sorry, this is not, of course, not of x. This is function for the group. So the fa, so we have n fa, which are functions from the group to R. So this means that, in fact, we have n equations, fa of g equals 0, because the fa are functions from the group onto the real numbers. Okay? Okay, so the question then is, can we write such an equation, such an integral, a trivial integral, in the same form as an integral like that? And the answer is yes, but simply, what you have to do is to define, to be a little bit carefully, what is the Jacobian matrix. Okay, because now we have an application F from G to a group onto a vector space. Okay, so now, in order to do that, simply, let us consider the following function. Let us consider an infinitesimal element of the group that is of the form 1 plus I alpha. So it's an infinitesimal. Well, let's just say it's not an infinitesimal. It's an element of H which is close to 1. The unity here? Yes? Well, you can.
But it's just on the identity.
It's just?
The Lie algebra is defined as the tangent space.
Yes. Yes. Pardon?
At the identity.
Now you can take it at the identity or you can take it at any point. Simply, then you have to see what are the relations between those.
Right. So when you write H as 1 plus I alpha.
Yes.
Right,
yes, of course, but I'm going to do that just at the identity. You'll see why. So this means I'm considering a point which is close to 1. And so alpha, in fact, is a small. Alpha is an infinitesimal. It can be written as sum over alpha of alpha A, TA. And alpha A are small. Infinitesimal. Okay? And now, let me consider the f of g. Let me transform g into g prime equal g times h. So now I have an element of the group here, and I am transforming into a g prime just by multiplying by this element close to the identity. Okay? And so, Of course, this G prime is G plus I times G times alpha. Okay? Okay? So now I will define. So now I define what is F prime at the point alpha as F prime as an n by n matrix of real numbers, simplified by take FA of G times 1 plus I alpha. So this depends on all the alpha A's. And take the partial derivative of this FA with one of the component of the infinitesimal transformation. So remember, so these are numbers, infinitesimal numbers. So I take, can take a partial derivative of that, of this function, you see? And of course, I make this derivative at alpha equals 0, so that I get something that depends only on G, okay? So you can define this formally as dB of FA of G. Okay? So, or it's in fact a Jacobian matrix GAB that is a function of G. Okay? So this defines the matrix element. So this defines the Jacobian matrix. Jacobian matrix element. Okay, and I define F prime of G just as a matrix which has those matrix elements for A, B going from 1 to N. You see? Okay? So this is an N by N matrix. And in fact, this N by N matrix, F prime of G, is in fact a linear transformation, a linear map from Rn to Rn, so from Li of G to Li of G. So for any G, we have a mapping from Li of G to Li of G. And for the depending on the function F, the mapping is a different one. And with this notation that are a bit lengthy, the magic equation 1 equals something becomes, remember, I had defined first 1 as the integral over the group of the integral with the R measure of the delta function of G minus G naught, and if G naught is a unique solution of some equation F of G equals 0, then I can rewrite this as an integral still with the R measure. But now I can replace the delta of G minus G naught by a delta of F of G, where now this is a Dirac delta function on Rn equals Li of G, while this is a Dirac delta function on the group. Yes?
So do we need to be careful about how we're comparing F prime of G at two different points in the group? Because, like, you know, the tangent spaces might change.
No, because we do not need to, because here I gave a definition just in terms of the components. So, and then simply, these components depend on some parameters. It is a group element. But when I make a derivative, I make a derivative with respect to some of the parameters of the alpha. Of course, when you have to compute that for a group, then you will have to be careful. You will have the structure constant which comes out. So, but I'm just giving the definition. Then you have to compute. Okay. So let me finish. you have that, and as you can expect, what you expect is that you have the determinant of this matrix F prime of G. So again, you have a delta function on this vector field. Now, this is a function, so this is an n-component vector, and this is the determinant of an n by n matrix. Okay. Yes?
When you write your H and you write G prime and G times H, G is an element of the group?
Yes, of course.
Then what does it mean to have the sum of two elements of the group in this case?
No, here I don't have this. Ah, okay. No, first I define G times H, which is the product of two elements of the group. Now, if I express H, since it is close to identity, as 1 plus I, some element of the algebra small, of course, this is the first part of of an expansion. And in fact, if you look at this picture, in fact, you come out of the group in some sense, but you come out of the group at order alpha squared. Okay, so this makes sense. This is still an element of the group at that order. Now, if you write, you remember, in fact, you can, in general, write an element of the group as the exponential. You can write an element of group of exponential of I alpha, where alpha is an element of the algebra, of the Lie algebra, and the exponential is defined as a Taylor expansion into a big object that is called the enveloping algebra of the group. And it turns out for exponential of I times alpha elements of the Lie algebra, this belongs to the group. So you stay in the group. Okay? But that's standard group theory.
The other thing, when you define the derivative like this.
Yes. I need what?
You need a notion of distance between two points, right?
But the definition, the coordinates is defined by alpha. You don't really need a distance. You know, when you define a derivative, you just take, you have a function that depends on some parameter, and you take the derivative. You know, the derivative is, you can derive, when you take derivative of an object on a manifold, that's a way to define what are the exterior derivative of some function or some forms on a manifold. The manifold doesn't need to have a distance on it. The concept, the notion of derivative doesn't need doesn't require a concept of distance. It just needs to a function to depend on continuous real parameters or some other space, okay? So this is, remember, this is a number. This is a number, so I take, this is a function of several parameters, and I just take the partial derivative, okay? Good. So we have the same formula for the group, for integration over a group, okay? Okay, so now, the trick is to use this formula now. Let us go back to this. We need to compute this big, or we want to compute this big functional integral, but separating the integration over the gauge slice, the orbits, over the orbits and over the gauge slice, because they need to be treated differently, because the action doesn't vary here, and all the different configuration on a given gauge orbit, in fact, are different way to parameterize the same physical configuration of the gauge field by equivalent, by gauge potentials that are equivalent by your gauge, transformation, by your local gauge transformation. So exactly like in electromagnetism. Okay? So the trick is to use the same, this very formula. Okay? So we have seen that for any A. So We first consider what's inside this big functional integral. So let us consider a given A here, a given point. Okay. And now I want to write this identity taking for zero, for G0, an element of the group, the solution of this equation. So now, instead of working in a simple, in a little Lie group, let us apply the identity 1 equals something to the big gauge group G. So instead, yeah, so I'm working in a very much bigger group, but it's just a copy of the little gauge group on multiplied. There is one little gauge root at any point of space-time. Okay. But it's also a Lie group. And it has also a R measure that is just the direct product of the R measure on the Lie group. So everything works fine. Okay? So let us just apply one by just writing an integral over G and taking as G naught the solution G naught. So let us write now one as integral over the big G group. This is just the R measure on G, but I write it as a capital D braces with G, because simply this is G now is a function of X. You see, remember, G is given by the data of all the G of X for all X in M spacetime. So in fact, now G is a function from M into the little G group. So the measure is a measure over functions from spacetime to the Lie group. In our case, the Lie group will be SU2. Okay. And I want to write a delta function. Now, this is the delta function in the big group of G minus GF of A. Okay? A is fixed, so it's just a given element in the big group. So this is obviously one. But now, can apply our formula, and we can rewrite this as an integral over the big group, D of G, a delta function of the gauge condition F of AG times the absolute value of the determinant of a big object, that is F prime of AG. Okay. Okay. So simply, what are these objects? As I told, the R measure is just the product from all the x in spacetime of d mu of g of x. This is the measure. What does mean this big delta function, delta of the gauge fixing condition of AG? This means simply that, remember, there is one gauge fixing condition at each point of space-time, and there are n, if n is the dimension of the group. So n now is the dimension of the little group, of the gauge group. So in fact, what you have to enforce are condition of FA of A of G at each point X. So we have, in fact, a product of delta function over all the points in space-time and all the A, the generator of the group. You see? And for instance, if I consider, example, the Lorentz gauge, the Lorentz gauge means that FA of A of X is just d mu A mu of X. Okay? So, but remember now, I consider that this is a delta function of F, that is, so F belongs to the Lie algebra of the big group. If you consider that this collection of FA of AG of Z, F belongs to the Lie algebra of the big group. Okay? Which means basically that is a function from M into the Lie algebra of the little group. So you can view F as a function from M into the Lie algebra of the little group. Okay? And finally, and there, that's where this becomes interesting, what is this big matrix? Because you have to be a bit careful. What is this Jacobian matrix? Jacobian matrix. Well, by analogy with this, I will call it G. G equal what I denote F prime of AG. So, yes? Oh, of course, of course. A mu as a component. Yes, yes. Thank you very much. Of course, there are n components, three components for SU2. So you have F mu A. Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. So G equal F prime of AJ. What does it mean? This means that, remember, in our case, we started from a function F from G into the Lie algebra of the group. So now F prime of A of G is a linear operator mapping the Lie algebra of G into the Lie algebra of the big group. And the Lie algebra of the big group, of course, of the big group here, is, so the Lie algebra of the big group is just a copy for X of the Lie algebra of the little group, as we have said. So, in fact, it's a matrix that depends of two indices in the Lie algebra and of two indices in space-time. So in fact, its matrix element F prime of A of G. In fact, our matrix element depends, if you want, both of A and X and of B and some Y, with A, B going from 1 to N, the dimension of the group, and X, Y being points in space-time. You see? So, in fact, it's better to write them as some F prime of A of G. So matrix element F prime AG of AEB depending on 2 points in space-time. So it's a kernel, if you want. And how is it defined? It is simply defined by take FA of A of G at a given point x, make a gauge transformation on the gauge group element itself by writing, by multiplying it by 1 plus I alpha. But now alpha depends on x. Alpha is an element of the Lie algebra of the big group. So it's a function from M onto Lie of G. So alpha means a collection of alpha of x that I can write as alpha A of x TA. So it's characterized by n functions alpha A of x. So there are n infinitesimal generators of a local group transformation, one for each generator of the group. And so this is a function of x. If I introduce some alpha A, it depends of alpha at some point. See, it's not the same point x, so let's write it alpha of y. And I take the derivative, the functional derivative of this with respect to the component B of alpha at point y. And after taking the derivative, I take the derivative as the origin, so for G. You see. So formally, so this is a way to compute. It's a bit formal, but it's just a generalization of what we did before. You see? So now G is a linear operator acting on functions psi of x in the Lie algebra of the big group, well, of the group. So in fact, so it's both an n by n matrix, but depending on two points. So it's just generalization of the operator acting on functions that we considered in the quantization of the free field theory. Simply now they carry color indices. Okay. And we are going to compute this. Okay, so we have now this beautiful, well, this a bit complicated, but this beautiful formula. We have transformed one into an integral over the gauge group G of some delta of the gauge condition times the determinant of f prime of A of G. Of course, these terms and these terms depend on G. So we are performing an integral over something that depends on G. So, yes? Yes. You mean the direct?
I mean, you have the big group is the tensor product of the little group.
Yes.
So the Lie algebras are also the tensor
product. Yes. 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 No, it's not. What do you mean? You expect to be the direct sum?
Yeah.
No, it's not the direct sum. It's a tensor product. Locally, it has the same, you know, see, locally, the Lie algebra and the group have the same structure since it's tangent field. So the product must have the same structure, you see? And it just counts the number of what must be the dimension of the group and what must be the dimension of the tangent space of the Lie group, you know. If you were taking the direct sum of the space, the total dimension should be the sum of the dimension. Well, it must be the products of the dimensions. Okay? Good. So now, of course, let us put this one into the big integral we had. Remember, this is a formula that is valid for a given A. But now, what we can do is to write Z, the big partition function, as an integral over dA. I have the exponential of my Young-Mill action. And let me just add one for each A. written in that way. So I have an integral over the space of gauge configuration. Then I have an integral over the gauge group, d of g, and delta of f of ag times the absolute value of the determinant of this big determinant. Okay? And all of each of these terms depend on g. But now, we have an integral over A, we have an integral over G, here a function that depends on A, and here something that depends both on A and on G. Okay, so all the E and the G are integrated over. So, since we believe into the rules of integral calculus for functional integral, let us invert these two integrals. A delta of f of A of g times determinant of f prime of A of g. Okay? I've done nothing. And now let us consider for a fixed g this term. It depends on G, but now G is fixed, and it depends on A. But remember, this is gauge invariant. So we can apply any gauge transformation we like on the A here. Well, let us apply the gauge transformation given by G. We can change A into A of G. What we get is, of course, AG. Okay? And then we are integrating over AG, a function of AG, a function of AG, a function of AG. So it's a dummy variable. So in fact, this integral doesn't depend at all on G. This is equal to integral over the big gauge group of D of G times an integral over the space of gauge configuration of D of A, exponential of I times the action of A, times delta of F of AG, times the determinant of this F prime of A. I'm sorry, there is no AG. F prime of A. Yes? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. No? Pardon? Yes? No, I'm considering this term. I'm just rewriting using the fact that if I consider this term for fixed G, so before performing, so before performing the G integration, I make a change variable that depends on G. But once I have that, I have an integral that doesn't really depend on G. So we have factorized our bigger functional integral. What is this? It's the integral of the R measure on the big group. So this is just the volume of the gauge group. So it's a formal infinite factor because it's a product of infinite, but it's something that comes out. It's just a normalization factor. It doesn't depend at all of the action, and if you had added gauge invariant source term or things like that, it won't be any problem. So it factors out. Great. We have now an integral over the space of gauge configuration with the actual original action. We have a delta function that forces up to stay on the yellow gauge slice. Okay, so we are here, we are constrained gauge fixing constraint. And we have an additional measure that takes into account the volume you have to associate to each element in the gauge thing. So this is real, the volume of elements on the gauge slice. Okay. No, it doesn't depend on G anymore, because once I have written an integral over some AG, of a function of AG, a function of AG, and a function of FG, I can redefine this as A. So this is independent of G. Okay? Good. So, so here we have the gauge fixing constraint, and here we have a determinant of some big operator. So this determinant is called the Fadeyev Popov determinant. So it's, remember, it's a functional determinant. Okay. So now, of course, all this is very formal. What we have to do is to compute this Fadeyev Popov determinant in a simple case. So let us go back and use the Lorentz gauge. In fact, I will use something slightly different. It's a modification of the Lorentz due to Feynman and perhaps Landau. See, I don't know. If, I think often the name of Landau. So I just assume that d mu a mu a of x, instead of being zero, is equal to some function epsilon a of x given function. It will be useful a bit later. Okay, so we are given a set of n functions. So this is a function in the Lie algebra. Epsilon is a function from M into the Lie algebra of the group, as usual. But I choose it to be non-zero. I can do that, okay? And let us compute what is f prime, okay? So remember, f a of a, well, let f of a of x is now just d mu a of x minus epsilon a of x, okay? Now, let me perform an infinitesimal gauge transformation on that. So what is that's written here? What is f prime a of g? It means that I start from a, I make a local gauge transformation on A. And I will take a local infinitesimal gauge transformation because that's all what I need. I will do a partial derivative, compute the partial derivative of the gauge condition with respect to local gauge transformation. So I transform A into A 1 plus alpha, with alpha small. So this means that, remember the formula we wrote yesterday, performing an infinitesimal gauge transformation with generator alpha equal alpha A TA, where alpha A is a function of X. This means that I'm changing the alpha A mu of X into alpha A mu of X plus d mu of alpha A of X, where d mu is a covariant derivative, okay, which is equal to A mu A of X plus the ordinary derivative of d mu of alpha A of X. Well, sometimes the indices are up or down, but that's not important. And then, so that's the ordinary derivative. That's a term that comes out in Maxwell's theory. But then we have, for SU2, well, let me go back to example of SU2. So A goes from 1 to 3. And the structure constant are the epsilon ABC. And then I have A mu B of X, alpha C of X. So new terms coming from the fact that the SU2 group is non-abelian. Okay? So now what I have computed, remember, is that F prime A AB of XY means taking the derivative of F of A when I change A into this A. So taking the derivative of d mu of A mu A of X minus epsilon A of X plus d mu alpha A of X, or plus, let's see, plus, since I have d mu, plus d mu of the covariant derivative of alpha A of X. Well, the covariant derivative, and this is, sorry, the index alpha of the covariant derivative of X, because here you have an index A. It depends on the other component. Okay, and I take the functional derivative now at the point X when I make a variation of delta alpha B at point Y. And I set at the end of the calculation alpha equals 0. So this is the original term. It doesn't depend on alpha. You see that epsilon disappear. And here what I have get is that I have delta of d mu of alpha A divided the delta of alpha B of X. So this is simply the kernel of the differential operator ordinary derivative times covariant derivative. Well, the covariant derivative mixes the color indices, and this is the kernel of this operator. So this is F prime. You see? Yes? Yes.
Be another term because what we saw.
No, I don't see it.
Last lecture is that A transforms as by conjugation with the group element, and there is a derivative term of the group element. Right?
Yes, but there is a term here, so there is this term and this term. So I think all the terms are here. Yes. I just took the formula of yesterday. Okay. So you see that the Jacobian operator, F prime of A, is just a second order differential operator. So So f prime of A is equal to the operator ordinary derivative times covariant derivative. So it is a order two, it's in an order two differential operator. So what we have to compute here, this Fadeyev-Popov determinant, is a functional determinant of a differential operator. Okay? So this formula is very important because that's a simple form of the Fadeyev-Popov determinant in the case of this gauge. That you can write in a compact way, d of A equal epsilon, in a very compact way. Ordinary derivative of A equal some fixed function, okay? And so you see that, in fact, you expect that this term will modify the dynamics you would have expected if you have not taken into account the gauge fixing in a proper way, because these terms depend on A. Because for an unabelian case, it contains an A. So it depends on A, on the gauge fixing condition. Okay? Yes? Yes, I have one bracket. Well, yes, I have one. I have one bracket and another bracket here. Yes, I am taking the variation of this term where I apply derivative onto all these terms, and I'm taking the variation of this when I make a variation of alpha of y at point y. Is that okay? My indices do match up. Oh, I'm sorry. I am very sorry. Yes. I counted twice the d mu. Yes, no, sorry. So either, yes, okay. So better to write this like. This is d mu of a mu when I change a mu by this term. So I get a mu minus epsilon a plus this term.
But the d mu act on epsilon a?
Pardon?
Does the partial derivative act on epsilon a?
Yeah.
It acts on epsilon a. Yes, so hence this term. You're right. No. The partial derivative acts on epsilon A, but this term doesn't depend on alpha. Yes. Pardon? I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. I start to be completely confused. So I should have written it like that. So, yes, so this epsilon A is outside the variation. Yes, I'm very sorry. Yes. Okay. Minus epsilon A. Yes, and here I think it's correct. Yes, I'm very sorry. Yes.
For this expression for if A, this doesn't equal zero.
Pardon?
Why does this expression for if A, given the definition of epsilon, not just equal zero? This if A equals derivative of A minus epsilon.
Why should it be zero?
Well, given this the equation in the box there.
This?
Then
I'm sorry.
Then
yes?
And so it looks
like
that would make
it equal zero. No, the condition that is zero is here. Yes. This is the general form of this determinant for any A. A doesn't need to satisfy this condition. In practice, we will have to count this only when A satisfies the condition. But when A will satisfy this condition that f A of x is equal to zero, so it's a Lorentz case, this determinant will not be trivial. It still depends on A. Okay? Well, okay, so now let's see what this means for perturbation theory. And so now we want to evaluate this big integral. Now there is a trick. Let us go into two parts. The important part is this one. We want to compute the absolute value of this determinant. So let us make a big assumption. Big assumption, let us assume that the determinant of this Fadeev Popov operator that I write now d mu, that depends on A, let us assume that it doesn't change sign, at least in the vicinity of the space of configurations that we need to study when performing gauge perturbation theory. So it's a strong assumption, at least for A close to zero perturbation theory. It's a big assumption, so. Then we can get rid of the absolute value. So instead of computing the absolute value of the determinant, absolute value of the determinant can be replaced by the determinant itself. And now here is a second beautiful trick introduced by Fadeev and Popov, which is to introduce, to compute this determinant introduce ghost fields. Yes.
I think I'm probably missing something, but can it still, it can still be negative if it doesn't change sign.
Yeah, it can be negative, but if it is negative, it means simply that you have a minus sign in front. Well, no, you have a minus sign, and when you compute correlation function, observable, you simply always compute some big functional integral with the observable divided by the big functional integral without the integral. So if you have problems in normalizing the measure, if you have a minus sign, you can just say, oh, my measure was negative instead of being positive. It doesn't change. So it's not, this is not a problem. The problem will be zero modes, and the problem will be what's happened if there is a gauge field configuration where this determinant vanishes, so and hence change sign. So what happens if there are configuration of the gauge field where this Fadeev Popov operator, this Jacobian operator, has zero eigenvalues, namely has what is called zero modes, because they reflect some physical problem question. They reflect some physical, they have physical significance. Good.
And just one more. So how can we, what justification do we have, or how can we motivate the fact that it does not change sign physically? Is there some sort of way we can motivate?
Well, I think that's the result of the calculation. You do the calculation in some simple gauge. In perturbation theory, for gauge configuration close to the origin, so small fluctuation of the gauge field around the origin, and you look whether there are zero modes or not. And usually, you have zero modes. When you have zero modes, they're associated to the global structure of the gauge field configuration. If, for instance, if it is not, in fact, a small deformation of the vacuum configuration, but it carries some topological number. And that's possible. That's indeed very, very interesting in non-abelian gauge theory, because the topological structure of non-abelian gauge series is much, much more interesting and richer than the structure of the Maxwell field. You have a lot of very interesting objects called instantons, called monopoles, called whatever it is, that contains physics. Okay, but I won't discuss that today. Okay, so I hope to go up to the end of the gauge field. So remember, in fact, now remember remember the rule of Bayesian integration over anti-commuting variables that we did on Monday, I think. We saw that if we have a matrix M, matrix, well, it's called AIG, we can write it, let us assume that it is Hermitian or symmetric, A equal A dagger to simplify. We have seen that we can write the determinant of A as an integral over product from I equal 1 to N of d theta bar of I d theta of I exponential of minus theta bar I AIG theta I, where theta and theta bars are Grassmann numbers. So we can write any determinant as a Gaussian integration over some Grassmann variables. So let us do that to compute this determinant. Let us introduce two fields that are complex conjugate, that are Grassmann conjugate. Let us me introduce a ghost field C, which is in fact a collection of to three, well, to n, and x belonging to m. So you see, so this is a field on spacetime with n components, but these are Grassmann numbers. So they are not real numbers, they are not complex numbers. Those are generators of a Grassmann variable. So they are like the psi field for the Dirac field. And let me introduce the what is called the anti-ghost field, C bar, which is C bar A of X, exactly, which A equal 1 to N, and X belonging to them, which is just the conjugate of C. So C and C bar as the analog of theta and theta bar. Then we can write for that, we can write the determinant of this object, d mu d mu, as a functional integral over the C bar and the C's and, well, and I will put an I here. If you put an I here, it just put some factor of I. That's the factor normalization. So let me write this as exponential of I times some action for the gauge ghost field. Action for the ghosts, which will be written in terms of those one. So let me write what is the action for those ghost fields. So the action depends on C bar, and it turns out that it must depend on the gauge field. So what is this action? This action for the ghost field action. This is simply integral over X, so over M, of C bar A of X times this operator, d mu times d mu, so the ordinary derivative times the covariant derivative. Both are applied to the object that is on the right, of course, CA of X. Okay. But now, remember that d mu is the covariant derivative. This is d mu. So this is integral over dx, c bar a of x. I'm sorry, it starts to be here. And then I have d mu of the ordinary derivative. So d mu is applied to an object that is the ordinary derivative of CA of x. Plus the structure constant of the group, epsilon ABC, A mu B of X times C B of X. Okay? So this term involves, you know, there are two derivatives. First, I have, so I can rewrite this, of course, once again, as integral dx of C bar A of X. Then I first have the scalar Laplacian associated to C A of X. And then I have a term that involves the gauge field. Then I have epsilon A B C times, well, I can have d mu of, well, I have epsilon A B C, I have C bar A of X, and then I have d mu of A mu B of X times CB of X plus A mu B of X times the derivative d mu associated to CB of X. Yes? Yes, but in that case, you see that, yes, in fact, it is written like, I'm sorry, this is the component A of this object, yes. Because you see, in the covariant derivative acts on the indices. So in fact, in these terms, CA is coupled with some CB, with a matrix that involves epsilon ABC and the B component of the gauge field. So you see that you can compute this determinant by introducing ghost fields plus anti-ghost. But those ghosts have two properties. They carry charges. They carry charges because they have a color index. They belong to the adjoint representation of the group. So they carry the same quantum number than the gauge field. Same as the gauge field. Okay. They interact. Yes. No, here I have written the covariant derivative in terms of the ordinary derivative of A mu. And since C belongs to the adjoint, so from the point of view of group theory, C carries a color indices, so it carries the same, it belongs to the adjoint representation. So the covariant derivative on the C acts exactly as the covariant derivative acts on the gauge field. Okay? Pardon? That's because it carries a group, a, an index element A. So there are three components. In fact, the Gauss field is a three vector. And, well, you work out about the fact that this you know, this determinant is an operator, remember, from the Lie algebra onto the Lie algebra. So it's an operator acting onto the adjoint representation, onto the vector space of the adjoint representation. So when you represent this determinant as an integral over anti-commuting variables, they have to belong to the vector space in which this determinant is calculated, okay? Okay, so let me finish in 30 seconds. They carry charges same as the gauge field because they belong to the adjoint representation of G, namely the Lie, which is the same thing that the Lie algebra of G from the point of view of vector space. They, since they carry charges, they interact with the gauge field. This is an interaction term. You see? But now let us look at the free part, the quadratic part. The quadratic part is such that this looks, this is very similar to the kinetic part for the scalar boson. It's just a Laplacian. And that's quite to be expected because they carry no Lorentz indices. So the charges are spin zero fields. They carry no Dirac or no Lorentz indices. Yes? I'm very sorry. Yes. No, no, I'm really sorry. That's because here it's a C, of course. It's B and C. Here there was a C. Yes. So thank you very much. One more typo. This is, of course, a C. I'm just taking this formula and wrote on a C. So I'm sorry. So there are spin zero field. The propagator is just a 1 over delta, so it's behaved like 1 over k squared, like a scalar field. But there are fermions in the sense that they are anti-commuting. So we expect that since there are fermions, if we are constructing this object in an operatorial formalism by canonical quantization, we would have anti-commutation relation. Okay, so there are bosons from the point of view of the spin. But they are fermions from the point of view of the statistics. Yes?
Is this not a contradiction to the spin statistics theorem?
Of course. So this contradicts. You are right. This contradicts the spin statistics theorem. But, well, if you know a bit about the spin statistics theorem, the spin statistics theorem requires that the theory is Lorentz invariant, it is local, and it is unitary. Uh, unless there is unitarity. And unitarity means, in fact, that they give negative norm states. So if you try to construct an Fock space, an Hilbert space of a theory containing ghosts, they will contain negative norm states, which is bad, but which is good, because these negative norm states will cancel out the contribution of the longitudinal modes, the mode with non-unphysical polarization of the gauge field, that gives also negative probabilities. And that's what I'm going to explain tomorrow. So in fact, the cure the unphysical polarization problems of non-abelian gauge series.